How does this relate to Michigan? Screams a man. In honor of Fahrenheit 11/9, what politics story from your lifetime would make a good movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Sarah Palin's Katie Couric interview. I think I want like a real-time show of how they prepared for each of them or didn't prepare, as the case may be, and then kind of have like the Frost-Nixon moment of two titans coming head-to-head and then what we know happened next.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with whenever that time was that Hillary Clinton bleached those computers to get rid of 30,000 emails.
Okay.
Monster. Shut up.
Hey, it's me, Dave the Seven. I'm going to say the making of Tabor, the Colorado Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, but something that extends into the current issues about limiting government, like sorry to bother you, but about taxes and libertarians instead of business. Hire me.
My word.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with the I had his name when we started recording. John
Obama?
Edwards. John Edwards. I want a really, like a Todd Solondz movie about John Edwards. I just think.
As if it wouldn't be grim enough as it is.
No, I just want something really gross and grimy. But maybe once the current regime is behind us, I don't need a movie about a shitty Democrat right now.
Yeah, we may have.
Which is a piece of shit as John Edwards.
Past the threshold.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting It in the War Room. It's episode 230 and it's the week of Wednesday, September 19th. On that day in 1970, Mary Tyler Moore Show premiered. Hello, I'm back. David's back.
Yo.
We came back from Toronto.
Back.
As I understand, not much happened while we were gone and you guys were responsible stewards of the show. So thanks.
Yeah, we had a great time without you. We had a party in the house.
Well, here's my experience at TIFF was I landed and then learned that my podcast had been canceled. And then my first thought was to personally remind everyone that it hadn't been once I learned what had happened, just so that they would not stop listening and unsubscribe.
That's good.
That was the triage that I was trying to do there.
And then what happened?
And then Katie recorded an episode without telling me.
I recorded it and you could have been in my hotel room at 12:30 in the morning when I recorded that thing.
But
David, you also told her that there was like no way you were going to be around to do
it.
That's true.
Let's pull all the curtains back. David's like, I'm going to be way under. I'm going to be drowning. There's no way I can do this.
And I was. In my infinite benevolence, I'm not mad at any of you people.
There's nothing to be mad at. We had a great fucking time. We blew the roof out
at the blank check meetup, which was quite a scene.
Oh fucking hell.
What
about our meetup? What did you guys do at TIFF on behalf of this podcast?
I think a Fighting in the War Room meetup is like Katie and I getting a drink at Shoeless Joe's.
I just watched David filing a review outside at Shoeless Joe's. I think I mentioned this in my dispatch last week.
Did.
Just
I
typing really alone.
The Outlaw King disaster of 2018. That disaster being that I had to see and review Outlaw King. But at the blank check meetup, something, I can't remember who told me this, but it filled me with great joy. I mean, there is a pretty substantial overlap between Fighting in the War Room listeners and blank check listeners. And I think a lot of blank check listeners have come over this way, discovered the show, and through our various appearances on that podcast. But someone came up to me and said that they loved my, festival dispatch from Sundance, and I was drugged out of my mind on Ambien and exhausted. I really took that to heart. I feel like I should be doing more of this episode on heavily sedated or on some other kind of
next
drug.
Week, man. Your review of The House with a Clock in Its Walls is going to light up the internet.
I saw a movie called Beautiful Boy, and the message to that movie was, do crystal meth. So maybe I'll invest in crystal meth, and then I'll review House with a Clock in Its Walls when I'm jonesing for my next fix.
Broadcasting from inside the walls.
Well, David, as I understand it, you are mad at one group of people, which is the people who have not left us a review. Not those nice blankies who I'm sure I'll have, but other people who haven't left us a review. Leave us a review.
Yeah, furious.
Very angry. You could tell from the tone of his voice.
And now, loyal listeners can take a pause from talking about how much I grate on their nerves and yell about Matt and David.
Why would there's nothing to yell about? I don't understand.
Perfect so caretaker.
We actually
did a fantastic joke that was beloved by all
and understood widely. Yeah.
It's in comedy history.
I'm gonna also, go on the Blank Check wiki and make sure that's how the history reads.
We should take this time though. Somebody recently sent us a screen cap of international iTunes. I forget where. I think it was Australia after David disparaged the entire continent of Australia or Oceanic. But
continent.
That was a
continent,
huge.
My ass. It's a big
it is
country.
A continent.
I know.
But if other people want to do that, obviously we have the technology. It's very complicated to get to other international iTunes pages, but it would be extremely convenient for people from other countries to send us these screen caps so that we can read some recent reviews from those locations. I think that would be grand. So people can send
and
those
they don't even have to be in English. If anyone bothered writing a review that's not in English, I will either Google Translate it or just phonetically muddle my way through it and hope
oh
that
God.
It's possible.
And you think we're losing podcast listeners here? So this weekend, 8 million things came to Netflix. Like, it's unfathomable how many things came to Netflix. American Vandal season 2, BoJack season 5, a new Nicole Holofcener, I can't say her last name, movie.
Holofcener
movie. The Dragon Prince, the new show from the Avatar, Last Airbender people. So many things came on Netflix. So what did most of us do? Stream the show on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hell
take
yeah.
that, Ted Sarandos.
And in the show got little to no publicity. I was reminded to watch it because there was a great little profile by Katie Weaver in New York Times Magazine about Maya Rudolph. And this show stars Maya Rudolph and Fred Armisen, and it is called Forever. It's created by Alan Yang, who I think worked on Master of None.
I think he's a co-creator on Master of None, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he yeah, I believe that's
a very large creative partner in Master of None.
He also is a co-producer on The Good Place, which may come in handy when we discuss Forever, which flag it, stop right here. If you have not seen Forever on Amazon Prime.
But asterisk.
What the hell?
Because I've only seen the first four episodes, I have asked. Nope. This is a good clue for listeners who are maybe partially in the way or don't want to ruin the whole season for themselves.
I didn't even say not to watch. I didn't get to finish my spoiler warning.
Well,
and
I'm
asking,
finishing it for you. I have asked that they not spoil anything beyond the end of episode four.
So, okay. We will be spoiling chunks of Forever because it is a very unique little drama comedy.
Very
thought
unique.
Experiment.
Jesus Christ. I shouldn't have come back. Very unique.
Well, it's very... No, well... Hold
How
on.
Can I'll anything be very unique? It's not...
Shut
it's
the fuck
oh,
up.
My God.
Oh. Okay, it is unique. It is
Thank
unique.
You.
I'm
Thank
sorry.
You.
I'm drinking whiskey here and talking about Amazon Prime
Stream. The
truth Street.
Comes out. Okay.
I am just saying that there's not much like it on television, and the very first episode is a huge spoiler, and then the second episode twists. It gets even more spoilery. It's all spoilers. So if you haven't watched the show, I think many of us would recommend it. Go watch
it.
And now we're going to talk about it.
Yeah. The premise of the show is a spoiler according to these rules. So
let's just throw out the main premise here. The first episode introduces us in a total like ripoff of Up. Like the first 5 minutes of Up, not
100%.
Quite. Although I guess
it's better than
no, it's literally the first 5 minutes of Up, except neither of them dies in that montage.
Yeah, neither of them dies in that montage. But lo and behold,
they do a brilliant thing towards the end of the montage where they just keep repeating. It's like their whole lives playing out in front of them from when they met, when they got married, and so on. But
the mundanity of their relationship,
right? As their marriage, unlike Up, where it just keeps going and they get old and isn't it romantic?
That's beautiful.
In this one, it slows down to reflect, as Patches said, the mundanity of marriage, and it's just the same meal over and over and over again.
But to be fair, their relationship is not like they're not angry, they're not fighting. They're very sweet. They have a relationship. It's just like some things are grinding to a halt.
It's very funny.
Well, no, and it's very, like, I kind of expected it from that to be, like, about her wanting to get out, but they're very comfortable. They get along, like, all the scenes we see of them together are them making each other laugh and, like, enjoying each other's company, which it is an interesting twist on the, like, unsatisfied wife trope that does kind of get into.
She is trying to ignite something in the relationship, so instead of going to their lake house or whatever for the umpteenth time, they're going to go skiing. And of course, what happens when they go skiing? Fred Armisen's husband character dies. And you don't totally know that he dies, I don't think. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the amazing thing about this.
For a tree.
Yeah. He's going to get, oh no, hilarious. He crashes into a tree on the first time skiing as he's pizza pieing down the hill with a bunch of kids. Hilarious. Episode 2 opens with Maya Rudolph trying to buy a Wi-Fi extender or new modem or something. And it turns out Fred Armisen died. And it's shocking and sad. And from where does it go from there? Maya Rudolph takes off her life. And then by the end of episode 2, it's another twist. She dies. And episode 3 is really where the show begins, in the afterlife. So Alan Yang is a co-producer and has written one episode of The Good Place. And Katie, David, you have seen some of these episodes, and I wonder, it's really intriguing because this show obviously has connections to the show, but some direct ones. It's co-produced as well by Joe Mandy, who has written episodes of Good Place and is a co-producer on that show. Story by credits by a bunch of other Good Place writers. What's going on here? Do you feel like this show has a connection to The Good Place? Is this the morose, existential, Jean-Paul Sartre version of The Good Place that, like, for some reason could not occur because that show is either too funny or too sitcom-y, or it's on NBC, so it has to be one thing, and now this idea has escaped to Amazon Prime. This show is so peculiar, but I also think it wears a lot of its references on its sleeve, and it's a very, like, blunt conversation about a lot of the ideas it has, but it's striving for something, and I wonder if you think it has that relationship with The Good Place that it couldn't be just a side episode or a spin-off.
Well, it's not like The Good Place, because The Good Place is about characters who are in a specifically removed from their regular lives, and Forever is about two people who were married and who are stuck together in the afterlife for literally forever. Like, kind of the more specific version of the afterlife we think of, where you get to be reunited with all your loved ones. So I don't think it would make sense in The Good Place, just because it's a different afterlife with different rules and really distinctly different characters.
Yeah, so is it succeeding?
No, I think it's a lot more unsettling than the afterlife than The Good Place, which I've only seen the first season of that show. The second is now just on Netflix. But from what I saw, was pleasant and sort of focused about living better and about, like, being a better person and treating people well and all those things. And this is, I don't know. Sartre is, from what I've seen, the first four episodes, as good a reference as any. It's definitely focused more on ennui and despair and just, like, the fullness of life, not necessarily a moral quality, but, like, how one is.
It
does seem very similar to The Good Place.
There are rules, right? There's this kind of, like, lost, like, air to it all, where this world has been created by someone. Is this the final afterlife? Or, you know, when Maya Rudolph finally gets to the afterlife, her husband, Fred Armisen, is touring her around this neighborhood that looks almost like Edward Scissorhands, Tim Burton-esque, and he introduces her to this fountain, and for some reason they can't get that far away from the fountain. And I think that's just, like, an interesting little quirk when you're building these fantasy worlds, essentially, and trying to live and play by some rules that perhaps could have greater mystery. David, I won't spoil beyond episode 4, don't worry, but this world expands and we learn more about the other people that inhabit it, and perhaps what, not only is Maya Rudolph on this journey to figure out if she really wants to be with her husband in the afterlife and what the relationship means now, but there's definitely, like, more complexity to the story and mystery, which may actually be a turnoff for you, that goes along with the emotional journey, for David. I definitely, when they get to some of the other locations of the map in the afterlife world, I'm like, I knew David might curl inward when that stuff happens. But did you like that stuff, Katie? Do you like how this world kind of builds?
I don't worry about it over explaining itself, because I feel like part of the point is that everyone's kind of searching in the same way that they are in the current life. Like, they get there and Fred Armisen's like, yeah, nobody's really there to explain things to you. You just kind of go about your life. And Maya Rudolph says, well, what's the point of this whole thing? Which kind of echoes something she had said when she was alive. Like, what is the purpose of living? And it kind of basically takes the idea that, like, what if the afterlife is just you continuing to be plagued with the existential questions that you have now for literally the rest of time? So I don't think that they're going to go, like, worry about getting too bogged down in rules. I don't think they're going to have, like, a magical temple with a cave or anything like Lost did. I think it's more about opening the doors for more questions and kind of following the train of thought of Maya Rudolph's character of like, what, something else has to be out there. What is it? And kind of, you know, seeing where that might go.
All three of us who have seen it are married people. So what did you make of the actual like questions that it's asking about relationships and perhaps the way that it does it? Because I think it has this kind of heightened dialogue. It reminds me almost of if a comedian who loved movies, I think it wears its references on its sleeve a bit. And I wish that some of these comedic sitcom writers were kind of like steeped in playwriting. I think a playwriter would have a better time navigating the space. And I find some of the dialogue kind of clunky, and it's almost, they're trying to do the Yorgos Lanthimos thing in a way that doesn't quite work all the time. But how do you feel about the style journey?
I was going to watch this with Elisa, and then I watched it alone, and I think that was probably the right call.
Metaphor for marriage.
Yeah, I don't know. What are you saying?
It's very...
Can't you confront things together?
Oh, sure. But it's like very honest about and direct, and I think really taps into a lot of my fears of marriage, that like you won't be enough for your partner, and that like... you know, you'll inhibit them from living life together or living life to the fullest and so on. And I think that, that is, you know, those are the things that I worry about. And, the show wastes very, very, very little time in, starting to dissect them in ways that registered to me as feeling quite real.
Patches, I wondered if you had the same thought that I did as a parent of a young child, where like Maya Rudolph is concerned that every day is too much the same. And I'm like, oh my God, no day is the same. Like, that is not a problem that I have in marriage at this phase in my life.
I mean, it's important to note that this couple did not have kids. They chose not to have kids. And that feels like something of a defeat when they're talking the afterlife. They realized that Maya Rudolph wanted to have kids, and Fred Armisen kind of nudged that idea away. I do think it's interesting. A lot of the show is about what kind of conversations could we have when we were alive that we choose not to, and now they get the opportunity to have them while they're dead, and it might be too late to really make good on them. And that kind of leads to this one-off episode. This is an Alan Yang staple, I guess, because Master of None is all about, it's like, hey, we're just gonna have one episode that's about nothing what the show is about. Total.
Well, it's about the themes of the show, but not the characters of the show.
Reinterpreted by new characters. So this episode stars Jason Mitchell from Straight Outta Compton and Mudbound. And who's the actress from Downsizing?
Hong Chau.
And they are playing realtors in this totally like adjacent parallel story that is quite stunning. I think, Katie, before the podcast, you said that it was almost like a mini Before trilogy, all stuffed into one movie. And I read an interview with Alan Yang where he's like, yes, I mean, I love those movies, and I wanted to basically write that.
It's
it's referenced.
It's certainly inspired by those.
But it's, I mean, just,
I think it's
fabulous.
A disservice to that trilogy to say it captures all of the same things, but it's very much in that vein.
I really want a whole movie of it, to be honest. I thought it was truncated and kind of like, I just want a little few more beats, or where, what are these lives like?
How many episepisodes?
These actors are fantastic. It is eight.
Yeah, so this is episode kind of six of right eight.
So what worked about that for you? I mean, I think it's a daring thing always to kind of do what Alan Yang does and totally remove us from the main plot. Although this episode does wind back to the show in an interesting way. Seriously, every episode of the show has a cliffhanger that loops back to the bigger picture, which is
we won't say too much about what that does. No, I mean, it's like incredibly well written, and it's the chance to see these two great actors. And, you know, I tweeted about them in kind of the most facile way, which is like both of them gave performances in recent years that felt like they could get nominated for an Oscar and didn't. But I think that says a lot about them as like stars with potential who you want to see do different things. And it's kind of frank about, you know, Hong Chau, I believe she was born in Thailand, but she's American. And
she was raised in Louisiana, which actually there's a ton of Vietnamese people in Louisiana. That's what very
So Jason Mitchell is black, and so like that they are they're a couple who you would never really see in a movie. And they talk about this as their characters is like, you know, 20 years ago they wouldn't have been allowed to get married or like would have been looked at in society. So just kind of seeing them play with that, and then just like having this series of conversations, like it's like a Before movie. You know, those come around every 9 years if we're lucky. So in the meantime, we get this.
She is such a good actress. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm
they're
already a
so
hard
great.
Jason Mitchell stan, if you will, and he's kind of like an everyman. I don't know. I guess I haven't seen him in a movie in a while, but he seems much older in this movie, or in this episode. He's playing 30, but he seems much older. But she is a revelation. Like, I loved her in Downsizing, which no one cares for and is a good movie and everyone's wrong. But
Her character in Downsizing is just tricky no matter how. I mean, you can tell she's giving a great performance, but that accent is really tricky to get around and kind of the complicated aspects of it. And she's defended it in really great ways. And we don't have to relitigate Downsizing. But I think playing this character that is much more natural without kind of having to do that stretch, you see her talent.
She gets
clearly.
Her southern twang in.
Yeah. And who would have guessed? I had no idea she had a southern accent until
it's
this.
So crushing. Talking about relationships is wonderful. I think that's why I really liked. I binged Forever in kind of one sitting.
So you watched the whole thing.
I did watch the whole thing. Over 2 days, but I would, you know, I would watch it. I watched it with my wife. I was really happy to, and it asked some hard questions, and we get embarrassed because there's a scene where Fred Armisen is like nagging Maya Rudolph's character about putting. Actually, this is an important question. Let's end the segment on this important question because it's something I related to, and then we got in a fight, my wife and I, but an important fight because we looked up things on Google. So Fred Armisen is dealing with the dishwasher in a scene, and Maya Rudolph walks in, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And he explains that for the years that they were alive and now into the afterlife, he has been resetting the dishwasher to correct what she does, which is putting the forks down, and he puts the tines up because that's the only way the tines get washed. How do we all feel about tines up? Because I'm a tines up man, and my wife is a tines down person.
This is all such you own a dishwasher privilege that I can't even begin to engage.
I think most people outside of the city do.
I don't own a dishwasher, don't own a microwave, don't own a toaster.
You don't own a
you
microwave?
You could own a toaster. That is not a city thing.
You had a wedding and you don't own a toaster? That's weird.
Dave, you haven't seen the show, but you can have an opinion on tines in the dishwasher.
Yeah, tines up or tines down?
I usually do down.
Down tines. You protect that's your hands. Down. You're scared.
Yeah, protect the hands.
I mean, Katie, what about you? You're not answering this question.
I truly don't. I think I do both, depending on like how I grab things out of the sink or off of the plate. And that is weirdly of all the debates we have in our household about how things should be cleaned. Like my husband has very clear opinions on which direction the bowls should face in the dishwasher, but not on tines. So maybe it should have been about bowls.
It's just the sound that it makes when it's actually, you know, like going full bore, and then the splashing that's like done when I'm unloading it makes me think that through the grating, even the tines are getting clean if they're down.
This is kind of my thought.
That doesn't make sense.
There's Forever. It's on Amazon Prime. Streaming for everybody who has Amazon Prime.
I'm mad.
You should check it out now. It may not mean nothing at all. Understand nothing was done for me. So I don't plan on stopping at all. I want this shit forever, man. Never mind, never mind. Shutting shit down in the fall. So, the big talked about game on the internet is a new open world Spider-Man game by Insomniac Studios released on the PlayStation 4. It is not connected to any movie or comic book franchise. It's its own thing, its own plot. It's an open world game. You know how that goes. You find some towers, you activate some maps, there are collectibles, there are bosses, you get to swing around. I have been going through, as a Spider-Man fan that owns a Nintendo Switch, and this being a PS4 PlayStation exclusive, little pangs of wondering if I should purchase a PS4 for this particular game, or if it was just a rabbit hole that would, you know, they would go from here to Red Dead Redemption 2, and then I would just forever be playing PlayStation 4 games, even more so than I played the Switch. So I got a friend who has a PS4 and another friend who's into Spider-Man, and together we pooled our money to get Spider-Man for the PS4.
Ah. We'll
be playing it over consecutive Saturdays after his kid goes to bed. And we tried to boot up the first session this most recent Saturday, and had a little bit of trouble because there was a fingerprint on the disc, which for some reason messed with the install. Had to install it twice. But then we got it working, and it's pretty beautiful. It's a nice New York. You can swing around. Swinging feels good. When you stick to the windows in the daytime, you can look through those windows into empty apartments, which, you know, they're not populated with people, so they're not creepy.
Well, we all do it.
There was an open world Spider-Man game once upon a time, and I remember because I got it and went up to Columbia in the game. And because Columbia was where I went,
it's
also
like 2004.
Represented in the Spider-Man movie universe. And it was lots of like shitty big pixels that looked vaguely like my college campus. Is the New York in this Spider-Man game a little bit more detailed? I would imagine it is.
It is. I haven't gotten out of downtown, but that's a good start because I have been like Union Square area, Greenwich area, you know, Stomping Grounds area. And so far, it's not so accurate that I could like visit old apartments, but it's not getting New York wrong. But I would
is it
say
only
that-
Manhattan? Can I go see my old apartment?
No, you can't. No, yeah, it's only Manhattan.
But I would say the cool thing about this one is if you're like a Marvel fan, which you probably are if you're already playing it, there's a lot of cool Marvel Easter eggs. So you could find Sanctum Sanctorum or like Alias Investigations.
Don't you want to see the Wakandan Embassy, David?
This is why when I got back from TIFF, the PS4 game that I immediately bought was Shadow of the Tomb Raider.
Problematic.
Because there's no Marvel shit in that.
Well,
apparently Patches, who does not have a PlayStation 4.
No.
But works at Polygon.com, which means it's sort of his business to know about this, has some sort of crazy take on Spider-Man.
It's not exactly a crazy take on Spider-Man, but I mean, I was intrigued by a lot of the conversation and the critical writing, which you can find out there on all sorts of sites, about Spider-Man becoming like a part of the police and that being a bad thing. Because I think in the game, you activate police towers and you're helping assist the NYPD in arresting people. And I think some people in this climate just saw that as a negative, like the inclusion of the NYPD, seeing this hero align with the authority rang. It was disturbing to them. But I wanted to throw something out here that's a bit of a tangent, and I wanted to get your read on all this.
Bit of a tangent off the hidden racism in like a Spider-Man game?
No, it's all connected. It's a web, if you will. But I've been thinking a lot about Katie because Katie, over 4th of July, you
was
tweeted
by a radioactive spider.
Became Spider Woman, become Spider Gwen. Yes. But that you were thinking about patriotism in a deeper way and what it means to you. And this game made me think about it. And a recent experience I had, here's a story. So I was walking around some nearby, like a park near my house 2 weekends ago, and I had to cross a highway to get there. So I'm on this overpass, and far away, while I can see a distance on the overpass, I see this celebration happening. And obviously this is in September, right? And it's American flags. It's, bleachers are up, and there's a lot of like older people. It's a lot of red, white, and blue. The military is standing over there. I can hear a band playing, and I got really scared. And I thought that was strange that I would have this reaction where I see this display of patriotism and I'm like worried because I was like, who's campaigning or, you know, who's demonstrating right now and being super patriotic about it? And of course, when my wife and I are walking across this overpass, this guy in a MAGA hat walks by us and we're in Brooklyn. And I'm like, wow, what is going on? We have to walk over there and see. So we navigate ourselves over to this rally or whatever is going on. Deeply scary. I'm about to enter the fray of American flag waving. I'm seeing members of the military standing there. What is going on? They are dedicating a park to a fallen soldier. And I'm like, okay, that's of course.
How dare they?
No, I mean, like, that's wow. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's like all these people came to the dedication. It's a wonderful display of patriotism. And I just think that's so strange for me to feel like, I mean, there were Boy Scouts there. There were Girl Scouts there. There were veterans of many wars of different generations. I'm like, this is a beautiful thing. This is American patriotism happening right here in my hometown, my neighborhood. I should be, I joined in. I was applauding like the patriotism of this moment. And I don't know. What do you all think about that? That it's like, are we in such a way that like, even mentions of the president in movies, I think we talked about briefly, what movie, some movie mentioned the president. Oh, Mission Impossible Fallout does this, mentions the president. And suddenly I'm like, oh, this sucks. What is going on? Or like Spider-Man is aligning with the cops. This is bad now. This is bad because it has been, everything has been charged and we can't feel connected to any part of authority or any patriotism in this country. I was in a tizzy over this event, and I don't know if you guys feel the same way. It does suck. It sucks.
Doesn't it suck? Isn't it?
I want to be patriotic.
America has like a soft coup by neo-fascists, and everything is awful.
But maybe,
yeah, it sucks.
But maybe I'm being too vulnerable here. I shouldn't see an American flag and get
worse. You're being too much of a liberal snowflake.
I'm a snowflake. I'm a whole snowflake.
You're right where I want you to be as a person who is a voter in the current climate in America.
Did you say boner?
Sorry. Voter. Voter.
Voter. Oh, voter, yeah.
Why would I? Oh, anyway. But.
Wait, did you say boner? You need to.
you're a perfect boner for this situation. All right. As a Spider-Man fan, you need to realize that this game will exist post-Donald Trump presidency. Yeah. And like in a game where Norman Osborn is the mayor, maybe, you know, some of those things might end up in the game. I don't know. I haven't played all the way through yet, but I'm hoping to see some, narrative nuance outside of just the reason, I guess, working with the cops doesn't bother me yet is because towers than a map system is just part of open world gaming, so they're police towers. And two, he's working with this Asian detective character from the comics run that I like. And so
maybe Spider-Man can make the NYPD better from the inside. I don't know.
This is like the conversation we had about Black Klansman.
It is
about
exactly
the
conversation we had about Black Klansman. Does Spider-Man
would
go
be
and
on
see
Spider-Man's
Black
side
in the movie?
He should in the video game. You can spend 2.5 hours watching Black Klansman with Spider-Man.
Yeah, there is, great.
I do know that at the end of the game, there is a teaser where Miles Morales gets powered up. So maybe we'll all be laughing in like 3 years when Spider-Man 2 like doubles down on the police and race. And Patches is like, I told you.
I would not say that. I'm afraid of America. The world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. David's back.
Tiff, baby. What a thing. You know, my main takeaway from, well, maybe not my main takeaway, but a takeaway I have from going to Telluride in Toronto is that, and this is very much, it's not even a problem, I was going to say it's a first world critic problem, but I just want to assess the landscape of the movies coming out over the next couple months, and that I've seen everything. There's nothing. There's no Phantom Thread. There's no Silence. There's no The Greatest Showman. I mean, maybe Mary Poppins, but I'm not particularly excited for that. There's no Star Wars, even. It really feels
Aquaman? What Aquaman erasure?
Dr. Aquaman?
Aquaman is going to erase itself, and I can't really get my hopes up for fucking Adam McKay movie about Dick Cheney. I mean, I'll certainly see.
You got to at least be intrigued by Bohemian Rhapsody. That's going to be weird.
People made that movie. I mean, I'm excited to see it, sure, hear the songs, see Rami Malek do his thing.
Figure out who directed it.
Yeah, I mean, I loathe Bryan Singer as a director on his talents alone, let alone his personality and his habits and so on. And then he was fired. I mean, I don't know. It's really hard to think of Bohemian Rhapsody as anything that's going to borrow a recently used Patch's word, penetrate the bubble of my top 25.
David, let's talk about movies you have seen.
Anyway, there's just a strange feeling to have.
No, because we're going to end this on movies you haven't seen again, because I am curious if there's anything that we haven't. But anyway,
there really isn't. But what have we seen? So I want to talk about what Katie said in last week's episode. Katie.
Yeah. I wasn't on Ambien, but I was very tired.
Yeah, why weren't you?
I don't know what I said. I was not on Ambien.
That I found particularly offensive. I think you got right to the heart of the matter on A Star Is Born, and that the first half is much better than the second, and that the one scene in the first half is absolutely transcendent, and that the score, which comes out on October 5th, not the score, but the soundtrack. the soundtrack. Oh.
Who did the score?
I don't even know if there is a score, to be honest.
Who wrote the songs? Because I had heard Jason Isbell.
They're written by a lot. With her usual songwriter. Oh. I'm sure
Jason Isbell wrote a song.
Oh, he did. Okay, great. Love Jason.
Willie Nelson's son, who has a name that I can't think of right now.
Billy Nelson.
No.
I think that this...
Eric?
This,
I don't know.
The movie will be a thing.
Gilly.
It's going to make $1 zillion, but the soundtrack, I think, is going to...
You think so?
But the soundtrack is going to penetrate our culture even deeper.
Stop it. Stop saying that.
No, it's going to be a real to-do. You're going to hear it on the radio. You're going to hear it.
I got
to
say, there are too many Star Is Born...
That sounds like a full penetration to me.
There are too many Star Is Born memes right now. The movie has not come out. It's just excessive. I haven't even seen the trailer.
Let me explain why that is. It's because, and I learned this over the course of my stay at TIFF, A Star Is Born - Official Trailer 1 is one of the great experimental short films of our time. I watched it at least 3 or 4 times a day while I was in Toronto because every cue, every cut, every fade between songs and modes, it's a work of art. I mean, it's truly an extraordinary bit of marketing and art to itself. I really, if I could put trailers on my top 25 list, I'd probably be able to find room for that. And If Beale Street Could Talk, Madeline's Battle, and all three trailers are just the height of advertorial
art. What has happened? You've fallen so far.
Patches, in his defense, this is not just a film Twitter thing. The Star Is Born trailer has been viewed 8.2 million times on YouTube.
Wow. I should
and
watch
it. Fucking rules. It also is like hilarious. I mean, Bradley Cooper, I was thinking about it while listening to what Katie was saying, is that like, I find this movie kind of ridiculous, but I'm not necessarily laughing at it or with it. I'm sort of in this vague...
It sounds like irony.
No, it's not even. It's just like I'm laughing at the fact that Bradley Cooper sounds like Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs because he has to be Sam Elliott's brother. But it's like it works for the movie, and so I'm not like... I don't know. It's just such a strange thing that this exists. And Lady Gaga is legitimately incredible in the movie and is going to deserve her Best Actress win. Even though she cheats by just being Lady Gaga and singing these incredible songs that cut to the heart of the emotion that you're feeling in a way that other actresses in other movies that are not musicals, as soaring and broad as this or at all, have that advantage. But what a strange and lucrative movie this is going to be.
It is strange that it exists and that it works so well.
I'm sure we'll be talking about it for six months.
I hope we all four get to talk about it in depth when it comes out in a few weeks. So
are there things?
You're skeptical that it's going to make this going to be a hit?
Me? No, I'm not. Well, I'm not skeptical. I just don't know. I'm confused. These are crazy times. Some things that we think will go away, they are huge.
And then,
The American flag scared me so much.
But anyway, well, there'll be plenty of time.
Well, luckily, the American flag's not in First Man, right?
There's no American flag in Star Is Born, as far as I know. So we can start that.
Star Is Born is an American flag. I don't know what you're talking about.
Can I say one quick thing about Star Is Born box office? Is that it's coming up from Warner Brothers, which had its highest grossing hit of the year, which was Crazy Rich Asians, and right behind it is Ocean's 8. So it's on this really interesting tear of female-backed hits, and I have no reason to think a Star Is Born won't be the same.
The biggest Warner Brothers movie of the year is Crazy Rich Asians?
It is. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's going to get replaced by Fantastic Beasts, so don't get too excited. But yeah, they're going to have a really interesting female heavier.
And this is
should have released the Snyder Cut.
I'm not saying that this is going to happen, but I think it's possible that A Star Is Born outgrosses Fantastic Beasts domestically.
And Aquaman? Do you want to put money down on that?
It's definitely a Clint Eastwood-esque movie.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, this could be an American
It has American Sniper written all over it.
Yeah. But unlike American Sniper, it
has no babies.
Yeah, it has no fake babies.
No fake babies.
But, so that wasn't, that, believe it or not, that was not the only movie at the Toronto International Film Festival. There were also others.
Movies are not going to be talked about for the next 6 months that we need
well,
to keep our eyes
it's funny
on
because Katie,
the Oscars
Katie
will
said,
fail these films.
Yeah, Katie said that David was off seeing all of these arty movies. And unfortunately, I think that this was really the first tip that I can remember just because of the number of higher profile titles that I had to cover that I really never wandered all that far off the beaten path. I just didn't
You saw the Claire Denis space movie.
Oh,
that's
well,
pretty arty.
A24 is putting it out.
Yeah,
I know. It's still artier than A Star Is Born.
Sure. Okay. If that's where we're drawing the line, then yes. The Claire Denis movie is fucking amazing. A24 is going to give it a big theatrical push next spring. So everybody will get a chance to see it as long as you live relatively close to a major city. And it's really, really wonderful. It's about Robert Pattinson.
It's not an IMAX film?
No, it's thematically, it reminded me a lot of First Reformed, and then conceptually, whoa, it reminds me a lot of that shitty movie Passengers. It's like First Reformed in space. It's essentially about Robert Pattinson, who is a death row inmate, who when the movie starts, he and a bunch of other lifelong prisoners and such have been sent in a penal colony spaceship out to the nearest black hole. And what they kind of know but don't really know is that it's really a one-way suicide mission. There's no coming back from this. They're supposed to like get energy from the black hole to bring it back down to Earth, but that's not happening. I mean, they are definitely all going up there to die. And they're up there for forever.
Can I pause for 1 second for you? So on Twitter, I saw people using the term fuckbox.
Yeah, I'm getting to the fuckbox.
Stop. I muted fuckbox on Twitter.
Okay.
That term, just so I don't know what they're talking about. Please don't spoil whatever that is.
Okay. I will not spoil the fuckbox. Although
I don't want to know anything more.
It's not like a code. it's
meant to say nothing more.
Literally.
Damn it.
So they're going on this one, but they're up there forever, for like decades, and time is a little bit different. Like, you know, there's like a gray patch on Robert Pattinson's hair that like slowly grows, but it's done very elliptically in traditional Claire Denis style. But he, by ways that I will not explain in this particular point, there is a baby born that is effectively Robert Pattinson's, and so he's like raising this girl up there, and they sort of really go to the brink of all human hope.
Does High Life have a fake baby?
No, it's a real baby. It's a real baby played by Robert Pattinson's best friend's baby daughter, and she is fucking awesome. I mean, the baby,
that's really cute.
Second only to Capernaum, or Capernaum, however the hell we're pronouncing the Nadine Labaki movie. She's incredible. This baby, I can't remember. I mean, the character is a girl. I just don't know for sure if the baby is a girl, but, it's a really, really remarkable movie. It's the kind of movie that by the time we reached the title card 10 minutes in, I was already like, yes, like we are in it. It's really something. It's going to get a cinema score of about Q- when it comes out next spring. I can't wait. So there was that. Roma, there were a lot of movies that have played the festival circuit, whether at Cannes or at Telluride, Venice, or Toronto, that I feel like I really need to see again before I can find my way around. Like Roma, as Katie was saying, it's very much a big screen experience. It's such a dense, majestic piece of filmmaking. But I think to really understand what it is and how it's working, or if it's successfully working on the level that it's trying to work on, I really would like to see it again. But I certainly want to see it again. So that's some kind of endorsement. But
do we know when it's coming out on Netflix?
December sometime. It's
okay, it's going to have a large theatrical release to go.
They are
it,
still figuring out if, to the best of my knowledge, if they actually want to do something really unprecedented for Netflix and put it in theaters only and then follow it up.
Oh, interesting.
Because as you have seen, in addition to a new Netflix logo and all that shit, it's still, even with the Coen brothers, even with Private Life, which is another wonderful new Netflix movie, it's the only Netflix trailer that does not have the Netflix watermark on it. And that's like the...
Did you guys hear about this new Netflix logo that is before Roma and...
Well, it's different before Roma.
Wait, no,
before
no. Wait, that plays in theaters?
Yeah, so it's not the boom, it's just an N, and it's got like this, so it's got like a rainbow of colors that goes into it, but then before Roma, because it's in black and white, which is kind of stupid.
Classy.
But no, it's very classy, very low key. I mean, Netflix is a dumb word. Like, I feel like that's them acknowledging that they named themselves in 2001 and maybe should have thought through it better.
No, just N.
They know just N. I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that Netflix is a dumb word. I think it has something to do with the fact that every time you play the Netflix logo in a movie theater, certainly in the environments in which I'm seeing movies,
people laugh chuckle
derisively. Yeah. Because they're like, what the fuck are we doing? Like,
yeah.
So now
I remember seeing Beast of No Nation at Toronto and everyone being like, how are we seeing a Netflix logo on an IMAX screen? Which it should have been.
You still
IMAX
get
screen.
That. I mean, I saw, when I went to see Hold the Dark at a small press screening in New York, everyone laughed. And that was just a couple
weeks
ago.
I mean, that's dumb. Like, come on. Netflix has been putting movies in theaters for several years. Let's get over that.
No,
but I do like the new logo.
I still think it's dumb. I think it's just like such a flattening of the home experience and the theatrical experience that I think that in a way, changing this logo actually goes a long way to fixing, well,
It's meaningless. Reaction. I don't know why you would think that that would be such a huge change.
It's just like the Netflix ba-dum is like, it's such a conditioned lizard brain response.
It's like this is your next episode of Glow, yeah, exactly. Not this is Roma. Roma is such a non-characteristic Netflix movie. Like, we'll talk about it more when it comes out.
People
but it's just,
are not
really,
can't wait to
the
skip
opening,
the intro of Roma.
They're not going
to
get through the opening credits of Roma.
Yeah, which, the skip intro for Roma will be 6 minutes long. That's how long the credits
let me just
are. Can't wait to see what goes instantly from Roma to whatever they autoplay.
Well, let me plant this seed now that you cannot skip the first shot of Roma because it is emotionally rhymed by the last shot of Roma and you will miss so much.
But I always hit play and then go pee and then come back just to make sure I'm in the middle of it. Well, it's Netflix, baby.
Don't yeah. do that.
I mean, as someone who has become to love watching movies at home because of the way my life works, like, I cannot imagine. I will probably rewatch Roma at home and,
said
have to go to the bathroom four times.
On a previous episode, so I'm gonna
I know.
But an episode that I enjoy listening to, I listened to it today in full. It was very nice.
David listened to one of our podcasts for the first time.
I know.
So he's very proud.
I wanted to make sure that you guys didn't cancel the podcast again or something.
This was the reason we had to do it.
Listen. So. Other movies, If Beale Street Could Talk, I think, is beautiful. Is another movie that I really want to see again.
When does that come out?
It comes out in November, at the end of November.
Oh.
How do you remember all this stuff off the top of your head?
Is that an A24 movie? Who's putting that out?
That's Annapurna.
Annapurna.
And, oh, right. They distribute their own movies.
Yeah. But I was very...
James Bond.
I was very pleased with the movie, my first go-around. On Vanity Fair, Cam Austin Collins wrote a review that I thought really captured my reaction to it. I mean, he speaks it from a place of more intimate understanding. But I was, as far as like the general tone of the movie and the fact that a lot of people, just because of the premise of the story and maybe because of how the promise of Moonlight and the sort of emotional tenor of that movie, might expect something a little bit bleaker. And it's not to say that the things that happen in this movie are not very real and very dark and continuing, but the movie's strength is in its generosity of spirit, its perseverance, its the love that it finds between these characters. It is a movie that will make you feel warm and happy inside. I don't know. In spite of everything, not...
I feel like he made a big deal about shooting on location, and that might have some...
Sure.
A big part of that, right? That's just what I can glean
from. Yeah, I mean, although...
Talking about Barry Jenkins talking about it.
Right, but I mean, and he did, and you can really feel that in the movie's bones, but at the same time... it's so accented, it's so colorful, it's so romantic that it feels, I mean, the go-to reference for this movie has been Wong Kar-wai, which is not where that conversation should stop, but I think in just terms of giving you an idea of just to how it sort of also takes place in its own little snow globe of senses is true. And Dave Franco has the single best one scene performance I've seen this year, or like one and a half scene, I guess. Other movies that were there that, let's see, I've got my whole
Wait,
list.
David, I didn't talk about First Man because I saw it after I recorded.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
Oh man, I loved First Man so much. And it might be because I was like tired and ready to go home, but like watching this movie about this man like going off into space and like trying to stay connected to his family. I did not think that I was going to be emotionally affected by First Man, but I really was. It got me.
I don't think I've.
How's the astronaut's wife?
other than maybe the end of Paddington and
Shut Up
Shoplifters, I don't think. I mean, it's literally going to be my number one movie of the year. So
stop fucking hell, Jesus!
But it's. I don't think I've cried. I mean, not that this is an indication of quality. I hate conflating the two, but and I'm still actually wrestling with the validity of my emotional response at the end of First Man, but the volume of my emotional response is undeniable.
I've been doing the same thing, and maybe we just need to like accept that our emotional responses are valid.
Well,
that's so surprising because watching the trailers, like I don't really get what the movie is, right? I don't know what the tug of the movie.
It's all
is.
About his dead daughter.
Seems very straightforward.
Neil Armstrong's daughter died when she was like 2 years or something like that years old, and he, being this very taciturn, withdrawn guy, like really buries himself in his work, and then all of his friends start dying. It's like he's blowing up in all these attempts to get to the moon, and it's really the story of a guy who is like building a tower out of the bones of all these people that he loved to reach this impossible sort of quixotic goal. And there's just like all this emotion, all the lives that they led and died for built into this. And you really, I watched the movie and felt on an emotional level, virtually nothing for 2 hours. And I think a lot of the handheld, super up-close style of the domestic scenes plays into that, where it really sort of blunts out any emotional response. And then in one gesture at the very end of the movie, and there's, I'm sure Katie knows exactly what I'm talking about. And
I do.
When you see it, it's like the floodgates just open and all the emotion you haven't felt pours into it. I think, like, to a person, the people I talked to in Toronto who did not like La La Land did not like this movie. I think that it fared better with people who did like La La Land. I think that people have their guard raised when it comes to Damien Chazelle, which, whatever. I didn't like Whiplash, so I'm sort of going on an opposite trajectory with him. But
I didn't really like La La Land and did like this. And I think maybe something that helps for those of us who weren't crazy about La La Land is Ryan Gosling is playing like a similarly like driven character who wants what he believes in, but he wants to go to the moon, not open a fucking jazz club. So his goals are better.
Yeah, but jazz.
He's a very Damien Chazelle character.
He is, but he's also like symbolic of America and the space race and the Cold War and all these other larger things, which I think really helps. It's like he is part of a system, not just like his own bullheaded belief that his art matters.
I'm sure, yes, he's part of all these bigger things, but one of the things I really liked about this movie is that it's really no bigger than this, like the enormity of what he's accomplished. It's really no bigger than his interior.
No, it's up to you to think of that stuff. But I think that's part of what I found so moving about it is watching these ships take off and just being like, we spent all this money on this stuff and we accomplished something so spectacular for kind of stupid reasons, but kind of amazing reasons. And I felt like it gave me room to bring all that to what you're right is a very intimate story.
That's why Trump's starting space. Force. Wait, Dave was about to say something.
Oh, I was going to repeat my question. How are the wives portrayed? Because I think in this part of history, that's like one of the more interesting things that actually happened. Like these wives were shooting their husbands off probably to die. But it's always really difficult, I think, to shoe into a movie that maybe isn't about that.
Well, congratulations to Damien Chazelle's fiance who graduated from being a bit player in La La Land, having the second female lead in this movie.
Oh, is that her? The wife of Jason Clarke.
Yeah. And I thought that she does a very good job, so I'm not going to say that she doesn't deserve her.
No, she's good.
Good for her. Would happily watch her in other things. The wives are, they get sort of the treatment that you would expect they do, where you see the emotional fallout on them, which is maybe more tension than previous versions of the story of Paid, but they're also, Claire Foy is sort of reduced to the conscience, the nag, who's like, don't do this, and I'm worried, you know, but there
I don't know, she's more pragmatic, I think, than I think you would see versions of this.
But there is, she's not overcome by the same, like, mania of purpose that he is, and there's a really beautiful moment between them at the end of the movie that I think sort of retroactively makes her character feel a lot more dimensional. Mm-hmm. But this is a story about Neil Armstrong and everyone, the wives, his other astronauts, they are all sort of in a shadow.
It is kind of amazing when they get to the Apollo 11 mission, spoilers for Apollo 11, but like Lucas Haas shows up as Michael Collins, who's the guy who didn't walk on the moon, and you're like, holy shit, Lucas Haas is in this movie. We haven't yet to see him in this movie, and he like doesn't speak. He's like barely in it.
Christopher Abbott's and you're like,
because he didn't. The fact that the three of them went to the moon together doesn't really matter. It's all about Neil Armstrong and how Buzz Aldrin was a giant asshole.
I did. Buzz Aldrin still is a giant asshole. One thing Katie said in last week's episode that I wanted to tweak a little bit was when she said that Widows wasn't fun. And I think I know what she meant by that.
Did I say that?
Yes. Which is like, it's fine. I mean, you don't have to like go to your grave with this. I'm just saying that like I know what you meant, I think, because you were talking about how Widows like engages with these more serious ideas. It's not as frivolous as Ocean's 8. It's not like a breeze necessarily, but it is a very fun, compulsively watchable movie. And I think that it's going to be on cable TV at all hours of the day for the rest of our lives.
I cannot wait to watch it again at all times.
I also want to give a quick shout out to this documentary that's coming out very, very soon. I think maybe even this week or next week, called Free Solo, which is about this guy named Alex Honnold, who is the only person. Well, I don't want to spoil the movie, but
this is a follow up to Maru, right? The rock climbing documentary.
Made by the same people.
Gotcha. People. Jimmy Chin.
It's a better film than Maru in just about every way. But it does play off. I mean, It's really about this guy's attempt to free solo to climb without ropes or anything else. El Capitan in Yosemite, which when you see this rock is just, I mean, when you watch him try to do this, it's the craziest fucking thing I've ever seen. I mean, it's just madness. And he is like, you know, they give him an MRI and show this fear centers. His amygdala is like non-functioning. And you're like, all right, it kind of makes sense. But he, it's really the story about, it's actually a really nice compliment to something like First Man, because it's about this guy who's like solely focused, monofocused on this mission. That's what he's living for. And then he starts getting into a relationship with this girl who meets him at a book signing. And suddenly he's actually responsible to somebody. And she wants to encourage him to follow his dreams, but is very worried about the fact he's going to die. I mean, the fact that all of his friends have pretty much, except for Jimmy Chin and the other filmmaker and his friend, like one of his climbing buddies in the movie, have all died. And like there are no free solo climbers over a certain age because they've all fallen off rocks. And it seems like making sort of your peace with the inevitability that you're going to be widowed or left with this new house in Vegas that they buy. And the filmmakers have a very palpable and active concern. This is their friend. It's not just like, you know, this morbid thing of watching a subject and thinking it's going to be a better movie if he plunges to his death or something. I mean, they really genuinely care for him and are in that community of climbers. And their fear is transmuted into the texture of the movie and their apprehension about even filming this and should they point the cameras away in case something happens. And it's very like Alex, the climber, is very cognizant of where the cameras are, and not in a show buddy way. I think it makes him a little bit nervous in a way that he doesn't necessarily get nervous. It's a really compelling documentary. It's worth seeing on the biggest screen possible because you will get very intense vertigo. The way they shoot it so up close, so intimately, it's pretty mind blowing stuff. A couple other titles to rattle off. I saw In Fabric, the new movie by Peter Strickland, who made Duke of Burgundy, which is not quite Duke of Burgundy level, but is very silly, very Peter Strickland. It's about a killer dress that kills the women who buy it, but fits them all perfectly. It's kind of like Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants meets a giallo horror movie.
So just Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
So it's just the Sister of the Traveling Pants. I saw Mia Hansen-Love's new movie, Maya, which was definitely the worst received like of her movie. Film. But I liked it a lot because I liked it a lot. It's certainly not my favorite of her films by any stretch, but there's a lot to recommend. I do hope that it gets a release. Olivia Assayas, you know, her ex-partner, his new movie, Nonfiction, is like a feature-length, very funny, talky treatise on the value of, like, digital writing. It talks a lot about Twitter and ebooks. There's a great running joke about Michael Haneke's the White
Twitter
Ribbon
account.
The White Ribbon. No, not the fake Twitter account. Oh. The White Ribbon. you get to hear Juliette Binoche talk about Star Wars: The Force Awakens and Fast and the Furious. It's a blast. And
you want to watch a movie that's about Twitter? This sounds awful.
Yeah, that does sound awful.
It's super fun and it's very thoughtful. And it's very French. So it's not just like let's talk about like Nazis on Twitter and Alex Jones. I mean, it's like a very interesting approach to it. And I guess one last movie but we also have to talk about Green Book, I'm afraid.
We don't have to talk about Green Book.
Well, it will come out in theaters.
Just because
it won the audience award.
The audience award, yeah.
I didn't like it.
Peter Farrelly of the Farrelly Brothers directs a sincere
based on a
film.
True friendship.
Aww.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to it when we get to it, but I think the internet's going to have a field day with that movie. So I guess the last movie I just want to cite real quick before we're done with the segment is Hotel Mumbai. Or actually, Kitty, you didn't talk about Vox Lux or Her Smell. As
I didn't see Her Smell, I did see Vox Lux. Which
you did. You did talk about that.
I liked it to some degrees and then right. Not as much for others. Did I talk about, I feel like
this
I
is
did
Brady
talk
Corbett's pop star. Movie
yeah,
starring
with Natalie
Portman. Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in Vox Lux. It's definitely worth seeing. It's
does she sing in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
She was heavily auto-tuned. She's meant to be. The songs are written by Sia, but what's really interesting about the songs is that I don't think that they were meant to be good. I think that, you know, Sia, who is like one of the most prolific, high-quality pop songwriters of our time, she wrote songs like Diamonds in like 20 minutes. Like the idea of Vox Lux, and we don't have to get into the nitty gritty of it, is that it defeats the purpose if Natalie Portman's character is this like transcendent pop artist, if she is singing songs that are toe-tapping, catching, getting your head, and make you feel good about life. They are meant to have a little shine of shit on them and to sort of feel chintzy. It's her sixth album in the movie. She's sort of going through the motion. She can barely stand up by the time she goes on stage. But it's really about the relationship between her as an artist or as a pop commodity and the pain that was at the genesis of her career, which came out of a school shooting and was like sort of tied into 9/11 as well. Yes, this movie goes to all sorts of fun places, but it's a really interesting inversion of what you typically expect from something like this. And her smell is, she's not a pop star. Elizabeth Moss and Alex Ross Perry's new movie plays a Courtney Love type. And the movie is sort of like Danny Boyle's Steve Jobs, but about Courtney Love. It all takes place in these like real time backstage vignettes over the course of however many years. And like after concerts, before concerts. And the first 70 minutes is like really Gaspar Noé level, driving you out of the theater and queasy. I mean, she is a terrible addict. She is completely out of her mind. She is being a horrible person to everybody in her life. And it's repetitive and you just watch this get worse and worse and more violent for a very long time. It's a 135 minute movie. And then suddenly in the fourth of five vignettes, it lights up and she is a new woman. And suddenly the movie is a complete U-turn to something much sweeter and more sensitive. And there's a lot of reward waiting for people who are willing to tough out the first 75 minutes. I've been told that my reaction to how much of an endurance test the beginning of this movie is was overblown. And I think that maybe in the theater where I saw the premiere, sitting in the back of it in particular, the sound mix was so muddled that all the conversation, which is meant to be a little muddled, was like just noise. It was just, you just hear this like Gaspar Noé, like Enter the Void sound of
they couldn't get
people
it right
like standing
Toronto.
On the next floor. And
what
yeah, I mean,
there?
Well, I mean, they finished the movie like the day before, you know, and so on, but, it all sounded like, you know, a huge party is happening on the floor above you. And that's like the only sound you could hear. And so I was like, wow, this is really extreme. I had told that the press screening later in the festival, it was a little bit less like that. But Hotel Mumbai is the last movie I want to talk about. It's one of many movies that's come up. It'll come up again that makes entertainment or dramatization out of a recent massacre. This one about the terrorist attacks on Mumbai in 2008, I believe they were, at the end of November. This movie stars Dev Patel and Armie Hammer among a number of Indian actors and some other white folk as well. No one of Armie Hammer. So Jason Isaacs is in it as like a ridiculous Russian businessman type. I thought a lot this year between the Utoya movie that I saw in Berlin, thinking about Paul Greengrass's movies. He has a new movie about Utoya, the massacre in Norway, that I avoided at all costs, but will be on Netflix soon.
You were not alone.
Yeah, and I will see that. I feel like I already saw one, and the one I saw was all done in one shot and was like so harrowing that I was like, I don't trust Paul Greengrass as a filmmaker enough to submit myself to 2.5 more hours of that. But Hotel Mumbai is sort of an action movie in the traditional sense of like terrorists trapping people in a place. And it's very harrowing. It's very, you know, it's at the behest of what actually happened. And so there's a lot of indiscriminate violence. But I think that, and the movie will get shit for focusing on, maybe some of the whiter characters. It is certainly not a white savior story and the white characters don't run away with the movie. Dev Patel is really the hero of the movie. And then this, the only real character other than the terrorist is the chef at the hotel. It's an Indian man who, saved a lot of lives and, really took charge and reopened his restaurant soon thereafter. But I think the way that the movie in its own clumsy, broad way addresses the common humanity that brings people from all these different backgrounds together that makes like, and it also, it's very interesting. It's really an interesting, obviously, contrast to the mindset of the terrorists, but it's also the movie deals with some less just naive ideas when it's talking about how the terrorists knew that everybody in the area when they started attacking would funnel into this Taj Mahal hotel because, like wealth and like colonialist, legacies and symbols of Western decadence, they're also beacons of safety to people unconsciously. You just look at them and you're like, I'm going to be okay here. Like everything's taken care of because of the money. And they all run there and they're just like sitting ducks. It's exactly what the terrorists wanted them to do. And the movie does not shy away from leaning into that and exploring the various ramifications thereof. And I think that the nobility that you see from the Indian characters who are, for the most part, all heroes in this movie is not cheap. It's not just like, you know, these like noble Indians who are, it's a really interesting dynamic to see how they all like ER staffers put the guests first in that moment. Like some of them went home and everyone who stayed was like, you know, we have to protect the guests. And that feels like potentially fraught and alarming that like even when it's a matter of life and death, there's this sort of like the, like, do it for the people who are paying you mentality. It's very sort of consumerist drive, but it's handled in a way that feels more humane than anything else. And they know the hotel. It's an Australian director who I wasn't familiar with. It's an interesting movie. It's tough to recommend. I found it like a very stressful experience and was really frazzled for the rest of the day. These sort of movies tend to have that effect on me, as I guess they should. I'm still not sold on necessarily on the virtue of making these movies. It varies for me on a case by case basis. I was able to defend the Utoya movie from earlier this year, in to some extent anyway. This, I think, maybe has more upside than down, but I certainly wouldn't begrudge anyone, especially who was personally affected by these incidents, if they were just thought that this was abhorrent, and I would happily hear them out. But Bleecker Street bought it. They're going to put it out, I believe, early next year. It's something. Armie Hammer is doing all sorts of fun stuff these days.
It's
and Dev
something.
Patel is great.
Yeah. A great endorsement. Well, wait. Katie, I have one question. I know we're running long here, but I do want to wrap on my kind of burning interest in the Oscar race as it stands.
We're
preparing for like 6 months of conversation about these movies. We really don't think there's anything coming in like November, December that shakes everything up. That
I think David is writing out the Adam McKay movie too early, which I think David.
No, I'm well, writing like, out the Adam. No, I'm writing the Adam McKay movie for myself. I'm not denying the idea that it could get nominated for all sorts of movies. It will certainly be seen through that lens,
nominated for movies.
I think.
Nominated for awards.
But it will not make my top 25 unless Adam McKay has murdered the filmmaker who made The Big Short, which I hated.
Wow.
So
he's got a movie about Dick Cheney coming, which I think is interesting. I'm definitely still intrigued by Bohemian Rhapsody, even though I have a hard time believing that it's going to be anything but a disaster. And then, I don't know, I don't think Mary Poppins is like an automatic Best Picture nominee, but I do think we're going to be talking about it a lot. It's probably going to get a Best Song nomination and like run the Golden Globes. So those would be like the three. Oh, and Steve Carell's insane Welcome to Marwen. Don't forget that movie.
Yeah.
Remember that trailer?
I unnamed sources have told me that. Well, I'm just gonna say you can count that one out. I think it's safe to count that movie out.
Okay. There's two more that I don't want to count out, but I'm getting suspicious of, which is Mary Queen of Scots, the Saoirse Ronan, Margot Robbie movie about feuding queens, which I feel like still has plenty of potential, but the fact that it has skipped every festival is weird, and I don't know why.
Of Brooklyn?
No, it's for a woman
no,
who is a theater director
yeah.
who is a first-time film director. And then also On the Basis of Sex from Mimi Later with Felicity Jones and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh, boy, that trailer.
The trailer looks real bad, so I'm not saying that it's going to be great. But, I mean, if you're looking at things that are going to be part of the Oscar conversation, at least for a little while, that's what's still coming up.
I think that the fact remains that this year is a lot more done than previous years have been at this time. I think that the fact that we don't have something huge waiting in the wings, at least critically, if not for the Oscar race, is important. I think that doesn't mean the Oscars race, you know, in the way that these things take on a narrative is not going to change wildly, and that we'll be thinking about movies that at least you, Katie, and I have already seen very, very differently a few months from now. But I think that I'm confidently like I'm rewatching movies right now is my top priority in terms of figuring out what my favorites of the year were, catching up with some of the small ones that fit through the cracks. But I kind of feel like it's done.
Aquaman.
Yeah. What does he say? Bazinga? No, that's something else. Booyah! I don't know. And there's so much we didn't actually talk about in the segment, like Destroyer, which sucks. And like Boy Erased and Ben Is Back and Beautiful Boy, all of which I saw and none of which really resonated with me all that strongly. Jonah Hill's movie, Mid-90s. I mean, I saw a lot of movies at Toronto. But I guess we can handle them on a case-by-case basis as we get closer.
We have 6 months until Oscar time, so.
Yeah.
No, but it's less than that.
Predator was truly far and away the worst movie I saw of the 51 Toronto movies. So, that's all you need to know.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will all be back next week. We promise no more of this separate countries thing. At least until someone goes on a vacation, I guess. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the senior editor of Polygon.com, and I am on Twitter at Miss Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with your friends by sending them a link, or you can leave some comments about what we talked about and chime in with your thoughts. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm a senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on the internet, on Twitter anyway, at David Ehrlich. You can find all my writing on IndieWire.com. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. Send us a message from anywhere in the world. It's all the same Facebook. So, unlike our iTunes store, it's from foreign countries to see it.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. I also do a podcast called Storm Spoilers. This week, we're doing Cary Fukunaga and Maniac, which you guys will all see on Netflix next week if you manage to catch up with what Netflix released this week.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com and on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. You can find all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where we continue to love to hear from you, and you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Fahrenheit 11/9, what politics story from your lifetime would make a good movie?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
I'm off the deep end, watch as I dive in. I'll never hit the ground.